Welcome to Addiction Talk. Thank you for joining us for another episode. Tonight, what we're talking about is life-changing. Make sure that you're paying attention, that you share this with your friends, with your family. Also, we'll be taking your questions tonight as our panel delves into the question, should Narcan be the next CPR? Take a listen. Drunk overdose deaths are now at an all-time high, according to some national statistics. To save lives, recently the FDA offered the over-the-counter sale of Narcan, an overdose reversal drug. Many have asked, should Narcan be the next CPR, with the majority of Americans being trained on how to use it? On this episode of Addiction Talk, we have a panel of experts who have been personally affected by the overdose crisis. Nathan Narcan Nate Smitty, Robin Vang Bigelow, and Philip Van Gilder share their harrowing experiences and illustrate the importance of accessibility to Narcan. Addiction Talk starts now. And tonight I am joined by the panel. We have Narcan Nate with us. We have Robin and we have Philip. Thank you all for one being willing to share your stories on this and to really raise awareness about a topic that we definitely need to talk about. So first I want to start with you, Robin, because we know that this is an important topic when we're talking about the overdose reversing drug Narcan. But for you, this is personal. Tell me your story and how you got into educating people about the need for Narcan and for all of us to be carrying this drug.
Thank you for having me here, first and foremost. My fiance, Micah, passed away in May last year due to fentanyl poisoning. Sorry, I don't want to get emotional, but you know, if fentanyl had not been in the drug that he intended to take, he would still be alive today. I know that for a fact in my heart. And so through sharing my loss and my grief on social media, you know, I've shared how Micah has passed away. And I just use it as a way to raise awareness about the fentanyl crisis and about, you know, how important it is to carry Narcan.
Yes, I think, you know, a lot of people think it wouldn't happen to them or it won't happen to their loved one. You know, when you think about sharing his story, Robin, were you all so surprised that this could have even happened?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Micah definitely had a past with drugs. But even then, I know it sounds naive to say, but I still never thought that this would happen. And now through sharing and connecting with others, it's every day I see another post of young people dying from fentanyl. And everyone just kind of feels like helpless because what can we really do to stop fentanyl and being in all drugs?
And when you think about sharing your story and just telling people about the dangers that are out there, do you think a lot of people are not taking this seriously and not realizing that many of us need to be carrying Narcan, which is now available, or the FDA actually approved it to be over the counter. But do you feel like we're not taking it seriously enough that there needs to be more of a wake up call?
Oh, absolutely. It's just like you said, how people don't think it's going to happen to them. A lot of people think, well, no one uses drugs in my house. Why would I carry Narcan? But at the end of the day, you know, people have young kids in their houses and you don't know what kids are talking about at school and what they're doing behind closed doors. And then we realize it's too late, you know, they overdosed and you had no way of saving them.
Yeah. And, you know, someone who understands that story all too well, Philip, I want to bring you in now before we go to Narcan Nate. Philip, I understand that you had to revive your son from an overdose using Narcan. So tell me about your experience with this and why you're so passionate. I mean, it's obvious you saved your son's life, but kind of share your experience. For some reason, I think, Philip, you're muted. Can you unmute yourself? We definitely want to hear your story. And I know you have a lot to share, but we want to make sure that we can hear you. So while we're waiting for you to do that, let's go over. Oh, there you go, Philip.
Yeah,
can you hear us?
Sorry, I hear you fine. And thank you. And Robin, I'm sorry to listen to your story.
Thank you.
Adds a level of sadness. Yes, about 5 years ago, I started training with Narcan because I felt that it was appropriate to do so for the community, and got in early in the Narcan, let's say Narcan innovation. And it turns out that several years later in my own home, my youngest son overdosed, and I knew exactly what to do. I'd trained enough and been around it enough that I was able to apply Narcan and CPR and revive him. And I've since done that with several other people in the community on the street. I've used it a number of times, but having to do your own son in your own home was a surprise. And fortunately, he survived. At the time that I did that, there were two other boys with him. And it turns out that 2 weeks later, one of those two boys, he passed away from a fentanyl overdose in his home. His parents weren't trained. They didn't have Narcan. I owe them a lot because I never made a call to them after the incident with my son. I thought that it was my son that was the only one using drugs, and I should have made a call to their parents. And today I live with that.
Wow, Philip, I can only imagine, like you said, walking in, realizing your son had overdosed, reviving your son from an overdose, two other boys there with him at the time. 2 weeks later, one dies from an overdose. And it's just, I think it's just a reminder of how common this is and how people are dealing with this. It's happening in our homes. It's happening in our communities. And Nathan, you know, Nate, I know you're out there in the community, you know, daily, helping people to realize what's going on. What has been your experience with people overdosing, and what have you seen?
What do you mean by experience? Can you elaborate on that with like when they come to or the substances or?
Yeah. So I just want to know, like, when you've had to, have you seen people or experienced people overdosing?
Yes.
And what has been your experience with that?
So typically it depends. Like a lot of people get out of jail or say some sort of program and they go to resume substance use and they don't realize that their tolerance is down. And there's a myriad of variability with substances like tolerance, weight, your health, you know what I mean, when it comes to overdoses, route of administration and things like that. I have seen cases where people have been endeavoring in cocaine or methamphetamine and the supply has been contaminated. I haven't seen that a lot, but I have seen that happen. And typically like with, you know, the response typically is different what I mean by that is if someone is opioid dependent, that their response to that is going to be just a little bit different. Not even that they're violent, but that it's more of a level of care. And not saying the person that's not opioid dependent doesn't deserve the same level of care, but we're looking at someone who is opioid dependent and they need a little bit more post response care, I would say, because if they might go use again and they might die, you know, and then we're thinking treatment and beds and things like that. If that's the options to seek and things like that, whereas someone that's not opioid dependent there, you know, it's not really at that level. I don't know if that makes sense or not. But.
No, that makes total sense. And my question for you is, do you think more people are overdosing that realize what they're getting? Or do you think that the fentanyl being contaminated in a lot of drugs, you know, such as Robin's situation, that most people have no clue. What are you seeing from what people are describing on the streets?
I think there's multiple factors in this. I think it can go all the way up to chronic pain patients, and I think it can go down to people experimenting. I think we have naive opioid users. Like people say, they get abruptly taken off medication. They're in pain. They're hurting. They're physically dependent. So they're going to be in withdrawal plus chronic pain, and they're going to go seek something to alleviate that. I had a friend that's what happened to him. He got abruptly pulled off his medication, went to the street. He thought he was buying a regular M-Block 30. He overdosed. Narcan saved his life. You know, and then it goes down, and then it comes down. Like, there is times where other substances come into contact with fentanyl. And like, really, no one really knows like where it's happening. There was a pilot study done in Mexico, and the cartel said that, like, that's against, if you look at organized crime and stuff like that, like, there's rules and procedures and policies, right? It's very organized, and they said that that's against the rules and policies. But what makes sense to us, and what we do know, is that it's people that are selling multiple drugs, and they're not practicing like standard operations and procedures, if you will. Like, they're not using a different scale, they're not using a different board, and then it's getting cross-contaminated in there. That's what we do know. Like, there is more I know people that work in policy have been trying to do, but they've not been allowed to do that. But it's a mixture of both. And then, you know, with kids, like with the kid thing, I think kids are, you know, if you look at the use rate of kids, it's remained the same, if not lowered in some areas. So kids aren't using drugs more than they were. They're actually waiting till they're older. But I think the main thing is the supply issue where it's shifted. That's the issue with them.
So we're looking at, like you said, I think that's really interesting, Nate, because you're saying it doesn't seem like more people are using per se. I know with the pandemic, we did have people turning to substances to cope.
Absolutely.
And things like that. But the substances that are out there are more deadly, you know, were you going to say something on that?
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't say that substances are more. I would say you just have more risks now, you know. Well, yeah, fentanyl is definitely more deadly, but I think there is a lack of education, a lot of stigma, and a lot of policy failure that goes along with this. Our idea of prevention is an hour speaker at a school once a year. That's our idea of prevention. You know, and it takes more than that. And then we don't look at why are kids seeking out drugs to do? Why are they doing that? And then why aren't we offering them services at the school free of charge? Like, those kids deserve services because they're hurting, you know.
So you're saying, you know, if I hear you, Nate, that this is a multi-pronged problem.
Yes.
Having Narcan available can save lives, but we have so many other things we have to think about when it comes to this. And Robin, I know you've been very vocal, you know, on your platforms. Are people still, do you still find there's this stigma when you're sharing the story of your fiance who died from fentanyl poisoning? Do you find that people are still uneducated and that there's still the stigma around it that you've had to kind of break through or get over just to feel comfortable to share what's happened to you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like what we were saying earlier about people having this mindset, like, I don't do drugs, why would I carry Narcan? Well, first of all, you can't even administer it on yourself, you know, it's to save someone else, right? And I think that's why I break it down with such simple facts like, oh, fentanyl is a synthetic opioid and Narcan can, you know, reverse an opioid overdose. It's just like simple facts, because I think when you get like too much in detail, then people don't want to pay attention. But like for me, with my social media, I share my loss and people kind of get attached to like hearing an emotional story and then they pay attention. Like, yeah, Micah passed away from fentanyl. And now we can tell the world by informing them that Narcan can, you know, save a life.
And when we think about, you know, Narcan being able to save a life, and I do want to delve into some of those issues, Nate, that you talked about, but I want to go back to Do you all think that everyone, just by a raise of hands, I want to hear your thoughts, that everyone should be trained on how to use Narcan? Okay. So when you think about that, you said, you know, Robin, when you're able to share a personal story, people connect to it, but they think this isn't going to happen to me. Philip, why do you think everybody should be trained on this? I know years ago, you know, there was a real push and still a push that everyone should know CPR because you don't know if you're going to be someplace and you see something and you make it save a life. So why do we need to be looking at Narcan on this same level of everyone out there knowing what to do?
So last week we were at the state capitol for recovery day at the capitol. And when I worked with, met with two senators and two congressmen, and my goal was to get them to go to something that Nathan said, to get them as part of our goal to add to the curriculum in middle school and above, not only CPR training, but Narcan training.
Well, you're saying middle school and above is what you guys are fighting.
Middle school and above. I want them to be trained not just in CPR, but it would take an hour. But as part of the curriculum, add another hour to do a thorough job of Narcan training in combination with the CPR. Narcan without CPR will not be effective. It's just not effective. You have to do both. That's how the rescue works, is you help that person begin to breathe and you remove the opioids from the receptor. That's what Narcan does. And you continue to help them breathe until paramedics get there. And so they need to be trained in the sequence of events. When we first got Narcan really out on the streets, if you remember, this is my 5-6 years ago, we were training law enforcement and they were refusing to carry Narcan because they considered it some liability issue. But we were doing it because of the opioid overdoses. We were not doing it because of fentanyl overdoses. We didn't even know about fentanyl being a regular active ingredient. Today, and I'll go to something Nathan said, when I'm working with addicts today, and today, what he said is, makes a lot of sense. They're buying from a dealer that doesn't, they don't have clean scales. So they're buying pot from a dealer, but the dealer just sold the guy before them fentanyl, and it's still on the scales. And now the pot's mixed, it's got fentanyl mixed in with it. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not pressed into all other forms of. So today, it's not possible to buy a street drug that does not have fentanyl into it. So if you're expecting a Xanax, you're not going to get a Xanax if you get it on the street. You're getting the drug that may look like a Xanax, but it's fentanyl, or it's a high content fentanyl. And so we have to train everybody, and it may not even be for your kids. It could be for the next door neighbor. I mean, that's the problem. It's that prevalent. It's the DEA said it. This is a chemical warfare. I mean, that's what's going on. And if you're not trained, if we don't train these young people, they're not always around their parents. And to what Nathan said, I don't know. I believe, especially now today, we're seeing here in Dallas, we just had an incident where these young kids have been arrested because they were selling fentanyl to the fellows in school. And so there were three children that died in the school. They purchased fentanyl from their friends who are also young children. I mean, it speaks to that. And
no, I see what you're saying there, Philip. It makes me realize, you know, this can happen anywhere. This could happen, you know, like you said, to a neighbor or your kid or anything like that. So, Nathan, when we're thinking about even just fentanyl per se, if it's in a substance, let's say by chance, how deadly can it be? You know, when people think about fentanyl, how serious it can be?
When we're thinking fentanyl, you know, the fentanyl is an LD50, which means 2 milligrams can be potentially fatal. So there's a 50% chance of dying. The thing that comes up is tolerance and route of administration. I have found people dead with a needle in their arm before. very much so. If you take it orally, fentanyl orally is doesn't have the best bioavailability. That's why they don't prescribe it orally or give it orally. You know, most people smoke it off foil or they use hammer pipes. But yeah, no, it definitely it can kill you for sure, 100%. With fentanyl now, you know, you really, especially if you're buying pills, like you really just don't know how much is in it.
And when you say 2 milligrams, is that such as, I mean, I'm trying to give people a visual of just how small, you know, I know that we've heard it's like 50 times or 100 times more potent than morphine or things like that. But how would you describe just how small of amount that is that could be deadly for a person?
Yeah, I think well, I
you're trying to hold up something
I
there.
Think it's the size of a sesame seed, to be honest with you. 2 milligrams is the size of a sesame seed.
There's three little dots on that penny that will kill you.
So I can barely see that, but you're saying what you're holding up now, three small dots on that, it could kill you.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what Nate just said.
It's that small, Nathan, the size of a sesame seed. So when we think about people, let's go back into the Narcan training and, you know, how to do this. So Robin, just from your perspective, now that this, you've had your own personal story, and I'm sure now you've learned how to use Narcan, how easy do you think it is for most people to learn it? Because people may hear this and say, yeah, but I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I could get involved. You know, should I even learn this? What would you say from a layperson such as yourself learning how to do this?
It's super easy. I mean, I learned how to do it on the internet. You know, I got my Narcan from End Overdose, and I think that's like a nonprofit organization, but they pretty much just make you watch videos to certify, ask you questions. And, you know, if you pay attention, it's quite easy, especially with the nasal spray available now. I mean, of course, it's scary if that ever happens in real life where we have to administer it, but it's so easy. Anybody can do it. Like Philip said, middle schoolers can learn how to do that, you know?
So how do we even know when someone is having an overdose? I think that's a question. I know, Philip, you've revived somebody. Nate, you've revived somebody. So either one of you, I'll let you take it away. But what are some of the things that you noticed? So if I did come across someone, how would you even know? And how much time do you have to act when you see this happening?
I don't know. I don't want to. Okay, I'll go. I didn't know if he was going to speak. So there's a multitude of signs. Pinpoint pupils. You could always check their pulse. You could check their pulse, like right the cardio and radial. You just feel that you count to six and times that by 10. So it should be 60. If it's below 60, that's concerning. You want to lay them down flat on their back. You can like you look at an angle and you want to watch their chest rise and fall. Right now, all of us, our normal respirations per minute are going to be 12 to 20. Anything under 12 to 20 respirations per minute is of concern. They could also have cyanosis of the skin, which for a person of light skin complexion is going to be bluish purple around the lips, sometimes the fingernails. Depending on how long they've been having a respiratory depression, it might spread further up their face. For a person of color, this could be a grayish white color. Mm-hmm. So, and then ultimately after you like take that route and you identify those things, the next thing to do would be to check for responsiveness.
Mm-hmm. I'd jump in here and say, I agree totally with Nathan. My first thought, and when the several times that I've been through this, including my own son, if they're not breathing, you go. And the first thing, and Nathan said it, is there's two things I would recommend. If you're by yourself, if you're with a friend, great. You got two of you. If you're by yourself, the very first thing is, and I teach this to clients continuously, first thing you do is you put your phone on speaker, you dial 911, and you drop it down on the floor next to you because you want emergency crews on their way. The very next thing you're doing is dragging the other person down flat, on a hard surface, and you start doing CPR and you dose them with, as Robin said, you just put it in the nostril and stick it in. And for the next 2 minutes, you do CPR. If you don't see anything from them, you give them another dose and you continue to do that until they begin to breathe. There's some other things that you can see. A death snore. A death snore is when they're like snoring. That's like latent stages. Like they're in the final stages of dying. But if you can't rouse them, if you can't wake them up, don't waste. Since Narcan is inert and will not harm you, you could be making a mistake. It could be a person in a deep sleep. It's so deep and you're not able to understand, but the Narcan won't harm them at all.
No, and I think that's an important point we need to say is that if the person isn't actually overdosing, but you give them Narcan, it's not going to hurt them. It, so it flushes through the body. If you see those symptoms, it's better to go ahead and act and do that and take the risk of it not being that versus not doing anything at all. So what happens, let's talk about, say I do have Narcan, I give it to the person and they revive. What happens? I know both of you have had experiences with it. So Nate, what happens? Because I think that's a fear in everyone's mind. Like if I give it to them and they come back, what do I need to do at that point, or what happens at that point?
Well, a lot of people think that people are violent when they come back. That's like a 4%. It's like 4% of the people are violent. So it's a very low statistic. That's just a myth. If they're opioid dependent, they can be in pain. And we also have to realize, like with my demographic of people, I mainly work with unhoused individuals. So you have to think about some of the trauma they've been through. Have they been robbed? Have they been beat up in their sleep? Have they been sexually assaulted? So they overdose and some random guy is hovering over them and they're in pain. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so we have to be realistic about this. So as you give the medication, if you do CPR or if you rescue breathe, a lot of times people say, you can sternum rub to try to, get them to come into responsiveness or a trapezius pinch, you know, and you'll kind of notice like their chest rising and falling and notice them breathing again. Sometimes there'll be a gasp of air, you know, and then that's the point where you want to transition into the recovery position. So if they do aspirate, they don't choke on it.
And we're actually going to show at the very end of this show. Stay tuned, everyone. We're going to show a demonstration on an actual person of what it's like to administer Narcan. So we want you to pay attention to that. We're going to go through that. But I think what you said, Nate, was so important that only about 4% of people are violent, because I think that is something that could be a fear that prevents people from wanting to do this, thinking, okay, you know, if I do this, what can I expect? But like you said, with so many people overdosing, I think we've seen a 50% since 2019 of people overdosing, that we all need to be aware of what to do. So want to go back to you, Robin. We had a major news, you know, end of March that they said Narcan is going to be available over the counter, which is huge because right now for most people to get it, you have to go to a pharmacy and then you have to ask the pharmacist to get it. You don't always have to have a prescription, but there's still this barrier of being able to ask for it. And, you know, but now it being accessible everywhere, what do you hope the impact will be, and how significant do you think that this is, that it's going to be available over the counter?
I think that's great. I did notice Nate had made a video talking about like, oh, how much is it going to cost? I think that's the only main barrier, because now people don't have to worry about getting judged from like a pharmacist. Why are they asking for Narcan? You know, just kind of the stigma that stops people from doing certain things, from carrying it, from asking for it, learning how to do it, you know? So I think this is a really good step.
And so you do feel that it'll make people, if they could get it at a Big Lots or some other convenience store, that they'll be more likely to pick it up? Because do you feel that people had a hesitation when they had to go specifically to a pharmacist?
Yeah. I mean, this is might not be the best example, but it's like, oh, young girl is going to buy a pregnancy test or something, right? Everyone's kind of like a little embarrassed or scared to do it. But I think when it's just on the shelf, you just pick it up. Even there's like self-checkout now, you know, just scan and pay.
I don't think that's been a barrier. I think our barrier is that people go, and it's something Robin said earlier. And I'll tell you what happened. 3 weeks ago, I was doing a needle exchange Narcan thing on the streets. And it was a Saturday. And I would have street people come up and I would say, we had little packages from them. There's fresh needles, Narcan. We wanted to make sure. And they would say, I don't do IV. Well, yeah, but can I give you these? Because you probably are going to be around people that do IV, and you could help save one of your buddies. And, oh, yeah, okay, I'll do that. But and so that's people that are actually in the community that are around it frequently.
So you're saying, let me make sure I understand you, Philip. What you're saying is even within those who are using, there are people thinking that because I don't do IV drugs, I'm not at risk.
That's exactly, that's what they said. And that was almost every one of them that said, I don't do IV. It's like we had to explain to them why it was necessary for them to take the product anyway. And so that's really the thing is, I think that mindset and is community at large is that the average person says, I mean, I don't know about the average person, but the person that's not intimately involved or connected like Nathan is, or like Robin was, or like I am, says to themselves, well, the people I hang out with don't use fentanyl, or they don't use these drugs. Well, the fact is you don't know that they don't use those drugs. You make certain assumptions. The clients that I'm seeing today, it used to be the clients, they were honest about opioid use, alcohol use, or I take benzos, whatever it is. Today, I would say that our opioid clients that come in fact, I know this to be a fact, at least 40% of those that identify as an opioid user identify fentanyl is their drug of abuse. Like they specifically ask for fentanyl. They don't ask for opiate. They're not looking for heroin anymore. They're actually asking by name for fentanyl.
Wow.
Things are changing. Opioids are expensive. Fentanyl is not expensive.
Right.
Opioids are detectable. Fentanyl is not detectable. And we have test strips. We were giving out test strips for fentanyl. Well, we were giving out our test strips test for 12 versions of fentanyl. Today, we know there are 37 versions out there. So we're hoping it helps. But if you've got one of the other analogs, it's not one of the 12 that we test for, it can still slip by.
It can still slip by. And I think that you brought home a really interesting point, because now we have people who are actively seeking out fentanyl. And then we also have the people who are thinking it's not them because they're not using IV drugs. And then you have the people who unknowingly are getting these substances and have no clue that they're getting it. They think they're getting a Xanax to help with they're getting it off the street, a Xanax, and they don't know. So Nate, when you think about, Narcan now being available over the counter, how big of an impact, or do you think it's going to have a significant impact? Or do you think we've just barely touched the surface on dealing with this overdose crisis?
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction. Do I think it's the silver bullet that a lot of people think it is? I do not. The price point is going to be key. Emergent during the naloxone shortage did not lower their prices. So I'm not very keen on them being lenient with the price, to be honest with you. I also don't understand why that naloxone intramuscularly, which I can get for $375 a vial, isn't over the counter at the pharmacy, because harm reduction groups have been giving it out for 30 years. If I can get testosterone from my doctor and give myself a testosterone injection, why can't someone give a naloxone injection into someone's deltoid, their gluteus, or their thigh to save their life? That doesn't make any sense to me. And people have said that it's not safe, but they've been doing it for 30 years. And even with the laws coming in, some of the laws that are coming down with policies are going to affect people giving naloxone and Narcan because of risk of going to jail and prison, because some of the new policies coming out are taking fentanyl off of the Good Samaritan law. So nobody's going to call. And so people are going to be left for dead again. So we have to think about that issue as well. You know, nobody that has 8 grams or whatever mandatory minimums that they're imposing now is going to stay and call or give them Narcan because they're not protected. So we're going backwards. We have to think about that as well.
So you're saying this is just touching the tip of the iceberg, cost being a barrier. So we need to be pushing for this to be affordable for people to be able to get it easily accessible. And then, I mean, I think some of the other things that you said, the Good Samaritan law, because right now in most states, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if anybody knows this in particular, that if you revive someone, that there's you're protected under this Good Samaritan law. It has that changed, or what are you seeing, Nate? You're saying that's already changing.
Well, for one, it's never been that way across the board. In California, it's simple possession. You're okay in simple possession of drugs and paraphernalia for personal use. But if I am on probation, parole, community corrections, anything where my rights are wavered, they are complicit with law to take me to jail if they want to.
Completely. So you could be reviving someone.
Yeah, they could take me to jail if they wanted to. You're not protected. It's clear. It's not in the law. In other states are the same way. And they're making it now where they're coming down with these mandatory minimums and harsh laws. Some states are even taking it off the Good Samaritan law. So if you call and it's fentanyl related, you are not protected. And it's never the Good Samaritan law is not it's not adopted across every state. Like every state doesn't have California's law, and some states are worse than others. And in some states, you can't even, you know, some states like in Alabama, in order to do community based outreach with Narcan or Naloxone, you have to have a nurse out there giving it out and writing it. You can't just get it and give it out. So
So there's a lot of things that we have to think about when we're thinking about looking at this overdose crisis. Robin, when you hear all of this and you're reaching out and sharing your message on social media, what are you hearing back in terms of, you know, the barriers? Are you hearing people say they have barriers, or what are you experiencing?
I don't really think a lot of people haven't shared their barriers with me. It's just usually like, how do they get it? You know, the stigma. Why do I need to carry this if I don't do drugs? Why are you doing drugs? Or why don't people just not do drugs? And I think it's funny when people think that way, because that's a really closed-minded way of thinking. Like, we can't stop people from using drugs, right? We can try and help them. But at the end of the day, like, Narcan gives people a chance to survive and to get better in the future. And you know, if Micah had survived, it would have gave us time, which is what we needed, right? For him to continue to get better or do whatever he needed to do, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, you pointed on something really interesting. I'll come back to you, Philip, in just one second. You pointed on something that's really interesting is, one, Narcan can buy people time. You know, if we can get them revived, maybe we can get them to treatment. But also, I think there is a stereotype about addiction. A lot of people think, why can't you just stop? People don't realize that addiction is a disease, right? And it's not a disease of willpower. So I think that there's this misconception out there. And do you find that we still have these stereotypes of what someone who is struggling with addiction or who is using drugs looks like and who they are?
Oh, absolutely. When people think of the word addict, they just think of people on the street that are homeless and nodding off. But you know, it could be your neighbor, it could be your kid, it could be your coworkers, and people are good at hiding it, or people are functional, or, you know, it's just people, there is a stereotype, but at the end of the day, we all go through different struggles in life. Some people hide it better than others.
And when you think about Micah's own struggle, I know you said there was a time in his life where he struggled. Would people have been surprised that he struggled at any point?
Absolutely. Yeah. He was just the best person, you know, the kindest person ever, super hardworking, had a great career. But he's had a lot of trauma in his life, you know, lost friends early, had a knee injury when he was 14 and was prescribed OxyContin. So he was just a boy. I'm not going to go too much into his history, but that's pretty much it. It's just a lot of trauma that people go through. And like you said, it's a disease. And when you use certain drugs, it changes your brain chemistry. And I think that's just basic science. So for people to think like, why don't they just stop, is really funny and sad.
Yeah, it's really sad. And I think you touched on some really good points there that, you know, a lot of people start out where they are prescribed a medication or an injury or chronic pain and find themselves. I think Nate was talking about his own story or experience of someone he knew that they were prescribed pain, then they couldn't get the pain medication. And then what did they do? You know, what do you do in that kind of situation? So, Philip, I know you had something you wanted to add.
A couple of things. I want to go back to something that, that both Nathan said and then Robin said, but it's not just young kids. We have older adults dying. The part of the problem is statistically, we still have counties that don't report overdose deaths. They report a death, but it's not connected because we have so many states that don't make this a mandatory requirement. They don't do an autopsy and they don't find, they just, it's a natural cause death or it's a death of cardio, right? And it actually happened because of a chemical in their body. If we were to have all the reporting done correctly, the numbers would be so much higher. On the good side, we are seeing today that law enforcement and first responders today are carrying Narcan. I mean, this is a vast change in the last 2 years. Also, there's so many places today where if you train, Texas, for example, University of Texas, San Antonio, does training monthly. If you train, it's an hour class online, they'll send you Narcan.
So there are some good things that are happening out there.
There are a lot of good things. I mean, in an ideal world, we'd solve all the issues that Nathan brought up. When I was on the street 3 weeks ago with my buddies handing out needles, that's against the law. I'm not allowed to dispense fresh needles, but you know what? If we can't treat people that are dead, I mean, if that's what it takes to keep somebody alive. And finally, I'll leave you with this. I was listening to a sports radio show that I listen to pretty frequently. It was on the weekend. It was people I don't normally listen to. And these two talking heads were talking and, you know, about sports. And they started talking. One referred to, started talking about a guy being a junkie. Those terms, we stopped using those terms a long time ago. I mean, when you start labeling people with those terms, you're harming people. And to listen to these two guys, I was thinking to myself, it was just hard for me. All I wanted to do was get these two guys alone. That's those sorts of terms. That's not helping anybody. These are human beings are talking about, but they've got these names, but they think, well, because I'm talking about a junkie, that's okay. They wouldn't use, you know, bigoted language. So they use what they consider to be accepted bigoted language. And it's unacceptable. It's unacceptable.
Right. So we have a lot to do when it comes to this. What else as we wrap up this conversation? First, if you are watching and you have a question, please feel free to drop your questions. We'll get to any questions that we can as we wrap this up. But what can we do next? You know, Narcan, Nate, you said is a good first step, not enough. What is the next best step? What are you hoping to see in the next year or so that we can really do to make an impact on this overdose crisis that's now nearly claiming 110,000 lives a year?
Well, here's the thing. And it's not popular, but the thing of it is that no one ever has to die from an overdose again, because with the overdose prevention sites, I think they saved out of all 700 people, roughly 700 people, they all lived. Okay. And the majority of the time they didn't administer naloxone. They supplemented oxygen. As Philip said, the oxygen is super important. And given it's a controlled medical setting, that's what they can do. And a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of stigma behind that because, oh, we're enabling and stuff like that. But people that utilize those services are 3 times more likely to go to treatment and 5 times more likely to stop substance use altogether. You know, the supply is ever changing. You know, we've never stopped the flow and supply of these substances. And as laws comes down, policies and laws comes down, the supply always changes to adjust and be elusive. So we really have to think about that. I would like to see. I would hope the FDA would change their mind on intramuscular naloxone because it works just as good. There's studies out there stating that people that use opioids prefer it because it's easier on the precipitated withdrawal. So I would like to see things of that nature. I would like to see OPCs taken off. I would like to see more funding into harm reduction. I'll give you a statistic right here. So in California, community-based harm reduction programs are responsible for 89% of the opioid overdose reversals in this state. But how come we get a third of the funding? And how come for-profit businesses and people with a budget and other entities of that measure are allowed to get their supplies from the budget that I am when I'm not for-profit? That makes no sense.
So it's I can tell Nate, you're saying that we have a lot of work. From what I'm hearing you say, we have a lot of work to do. Definitely a lot of work to do. So when I think back to Philip, what do you think needs to be next? What do we need to do? I mean, Nate touched on some really good things. He said, yes, we have the nasal spray, but, you know, we need the injectable to be approved as well. We need funding to help support, you know, harm reduction organizations that are pushing that. We also probably need, you know, more people getting access to treatment. I mean, I think this is a multi-pronged approach. Mm-hmm. So what do you see next, Philip?
Well, I'm like Nate. I actually carry, what I prefer to use is naloxone, and I carry it, but I'm trained to do that. And not everybody is trained to do that. So I carry probably, at any given time, I've got at least 50 doses of the nasal on me. If I'm not going to suggest that somebody go out and get naloxone training, Narcan training is good enough, but I am going to suggest that we start earlier, that we, a real simple thing would be to take an hour of curriculum for middle schoolers and above, because we're seeing people 12 and 13 dying now, to just take and do two classes. A good hour with refresher on CPR and an hour on Narcan. We've got to expand the army of people that are capable of applying the prophylactic to the solution. The legislative part of it has to be there, but if we wait for that, we're going to continue to watch the death toll rise. Because there are people like Nathan out there that'll do what he does. People like Robin that'll do what she does. People like me that'll do what I do. People like you that'll host forums like this so that we can get the message out. And there's going to be people that are just going to wake up and say, you know what? I'm going to get trained because I don't want to see somebody die. I can't do anything about gun laws, but I can do something about overdoses by being prepared myself. And I'm going to do that. That's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So, Robin, hearing all of that, well, very powerful message there, Philip, Robin. And as we wrap up here, I want to give you, you know, the final words. I know for you, very personal, you know, as you shared, your fiance had a bright future ahead of him. He was a great guy. He, like you said, he had a good job. He worked in the community. He had a big heart. So if there were any final message that you'd want to get out there to those who are listening now or who watch this later, what would you say?
I think I would just say, you know, we do just need to continue talking about it. Obviously, I don't specialize in Narcan or harm reduction, but I think if we just share our message and story, then it gets the message to carry Narcan out there. I've had multiple people comment like, oh, I ordered my Narcan because of yours and Micah's story. And just that, you know, people are already taking steps. I know people are afraid to speak about how someone died, but I think I just want to give a reminder that it's not about how they die. It's about how they live and that it's okay. And, you know, the stigma sucks, but I think the kindest people struggle in silence. So, you know, it's okay to share your story. And the internet's the internet. There are always going to be mean people, but trolls. But, you know, if you do things with your heart and with love and kindness, then that's all that matters.
Wow. Very powerful. to say that if you, you know, it's not about how someone died, but how they lived. And so many people are struggling, and there are community, there are friends, there are family, there are loved ones. And if all we can do is learn how to use Narcan as a first step, as just a first step, and then deal with legislation and all of that, that we can save more people and give them the opportunity to get the help that they need. So thank you so much for joining us tonight, Robin, Nathan, and Philip. And now for those of you who are watching, we want to end with a Narcan demonstration video that we have used over the years, just to show you how this works. So thank you again to our panelists and to you. We're going to end with this video tonight. Make sure you go out and get Narcan, learn more about the overdose crisis in your community, and help us save more people. Good night.
First of all, we want to make sure that they're not just asleep. So the first thing you would do is come up and say, "Hey, are you okay? Hey, are you okay? Are you awake?" If they don't respond, then like you want to go ahead and take your knuckles and kind of rub it on their breastbone or their sternum, because that's a little bit irritating and usually wake people up in their deep sleep. If they don't respond, the next thing you want to do is go ahead and see if they're breathing. So get your ear really close to their mouth and see if you can feel or hear any breathing. If they're not breathing, the next thing you can do, if you know how to, is to go ahead and just look for a carotid pulse right here. The final thing to do is to look at their eyes, see if they have, check their pupils. If their pupils are very pinpoint, if they have pinpoint pupils, and if they're not breathing, and whether or not they have a pulse, with or without, it gives you very high risk of suspicion they might have overdosed. The next thing I would do is make sure the person is on their back before you administer any medication. And then you're going to go ahead and you have Narcan available. We're using this nasal spray because it's very easy for non-trained people to use. It's very easy, just like a nasal spray. Just peel the back, leave that, you don't need it, and then pull out the nasal spray. It's just like an allergy nasal spray. On your dominant hand, use your index and middle fingers on the top, and your thumb here is to push the medicine when you're ready. You want to go ahead and insert it either one of the nostrils and make sure their head is back a little bit so you can see. You can even touch their nose slightly if you need to. Insert it in here and then use your thumb and press it all the way in. And then you want to turn the person on their side, what we call the recovery position. And what you're going to do is you're going to go ahead and have them bend their knee, like their leg, like this, so they don't lay on their stomach, and turn them on their side. The reason why we do this is because if they do wake up and they are recovering from an opioid overdose, they can vomit, and we don't want them to aspirate. The next thing you do is you monitor them. If they don't respond or they become awake and then become unconscious again, you could administer another dose of Narcan every 2 to 3 minutes as needed until help arrives. Some of the very powerful narcotics that are out there, such as fentanyl, are 100 times more potent than heroin. And when you give Narcan, it'll reverse the respiratory depression and it'll start breathing. But the drug's so powerful, it'll re-exert its effect, and people can go unconscious and stop breathing again. So you need to monitor that.
Okay, well, we just let you see a demonstration of Narcan. I know one of the things too that Philip had mentioned, the importance of also doing CPR with that. But that just shows you just that 2 minute demo, how easy this can be to be able to revive someone and save someone's life. And all of us need to know how to do it. Thank you again for joining us, and good night.